art, culture, politics, activism. Now, art in the pandemic age. Have you ever wondered why artists do what they do? What is their purpose? What are they trying to accomplish? I'm your host, Kyle Roman. Welcome to Artivism Now. Artivism, defined, is a portmanteau word combining art and activism. How is it that artists push the boundary of their medium? How do they move societies forward? How do they resolve issues in their neighborhoods, both local and worldwide? These questions are what we set out to answer by interviewing artists locally and the world over. We will get answers to those questions that artists put out there in the community. On episode 3 of Artivism Now, we profile AJ Mitchell, Actors Equity member, director of theater at Contra Costa School of Performing Arts. AJ's activism happens in the classroom, in the way that he advocates for his students and brings light to the issues of their community. All right, welcome AJ Mitchell to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Hey, so you are a local Bay Area theater artist and theater director. If you could describe kind of like your work that you're into, both as an educator and as an artist, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so I moved to the Bay Area about 8 years ago with an intention of not doing much performing. I was a part of a dance company at the time, and I was also working for the Department of the Environment. But as I was working for the Department of the Environment in San Francisco and going to an office every day and sitting there 8 hours a day and, you know, going through the rigmarole of that, I realized very quickly that I was missing having a full life of performance. So about 3 years into me being a San Francisco resident at the time, I was living in San Francisco, mm-hmm. Oakland, I said, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to be an artist. And so I did. I decided to be a full-time artist. I decided to be an actor and dancer and director. And that work introduced me to many people in the industry. I joined Equity during that period as well. So I'm a member of Actors Equity as well. But really what always has inspired me about the art form is how deeply academic it is, how rigorous the academic study of this form is, and how as artists, we're constantly investigating the human condition. And really using the scientific method to do so, but using the scientific method through the form of performance, either writing plays or creating works for the concert stage for dance. And so I became more interested in kind of the theory of work, and I started doing a lot of research and reading about the art of performing in general, which led me to creating this course called Art as Social Media. And I was looking at the performative nature of like Facebook and Instagram and who we become and how that is a theater itself and how that is a performance space itself. And ended up getting a job at Contra Costa School of Performing Arts doing a master class in arts and social media, where I worked with students to kind of develop their own persona and talk about what is performative and is and ask the question, is social media a performance space? And so through that work at SPA, I worked with them for 3 semesters and eventually was asked to head the program. So I'm now the director of theater at Contra Costa School for Performing Arts, in which I teach most of the theory classes. So I teach most of theater history, and culture. I teach a class called ISMS, which is a philosophy and theater class, in which we go through from late 1800s through 2000, through current times, and talk about the philosophies that drove the literature, dramatic literature at the time. And then I also teach some acting classes as well. So and voice and movement work. So I'm now dedicated mostly to education, even though I still have a career as a director and choreographer. I have been lucky enough to direct and choreograph throughout the Bay Area. And in fact, when we went on stay in place orders, I was opening a show the next day, and the Friday I was opening Footloose at Cal State East Bay, and we had to shut everything down. We were in final dress, and I had to give this speech to the cast that we can't do it, and it was heartbreaking. And one of the things that is so hard about being a theater educator and director right now is that for these students, they're seniors, many of them are seniors, and there is their final product and their final time to be at this particular stage. And it's a lot of grief there. It's a lot of heartache there because we don't have them anymore. Like I can work with my colleagues who are adults who are in the professional world after we, you know, return back to normal, whatever that means. Right. But for these seniors, and for this ensemble, it will never be the same for them. They're moving on. And that is, that's one of the biggest things that I think about right now with COVID. Yeah. So I spend my life as a director, as an educator, as an activist, as a loud mouth. I'm hoping to, you know, really think deeply about the world of theater and the world of performance.
I feel like just from the we've had a couple conversations at a Contra Costa Arts meeting seems like a lifetime ago, even though it was just this past school year. That's where we met, and I feel like, man, I learned so much just in that one conversation that we had. And then even just now in these few minutes, you're like getting me fired up, like, oh man, I can't wait to get back to my program and get things going. And just, you know, like it hurts so bad not being with your student artists right now at this point. Right. You know, I wish there was a way other than, of course, Zoom. I mean, Zoom could only do so much, right?
Absolutely. But
in terms of the personal connection that you get through the art form of theater in person, man, you really do miss it at this moment, because it's something, if you're an educator in the field, you thrive off of those moments with your students. And I echo your sentiment in terms of how you're feeling about, as an educator being away. And that actually brings us to the article that, Valina Brown wrote on Theater Bay Area. She had profiled a post of yours on Facebook where it really kind of, it's really an outpouring of kind of like your feelings of responsibility versus emotions in this time. Is there a way that you can maybe encapsulate that for us?
Yeah. At the very beginning of Stay in Place, there was this urgent movement throughout the community of theater practitioners to continue to create, right? Like put it out there. They will reference Shakespeare and how he wrote King Lear during quarantine and all of that. And there's this constant ask of, let's keep moving, let's keep creating, let's keep doing this. And I had this moment where I was sitting in my living room and looking at all this creation happening and this need for people to continue to put out material. And I thought to myself, I don't want this right now. I don't want to be a part of a reading. I don't want to create or to talk about how our theater is going to exist post COVID. I really want to sit and acknowledge how sad we all are, how much loss we all have experienced in having the stay in place order happen. It is I think there's this constant need, especially for actors or folks who are performers, to put on this face of, we're okay, let's keep moving, let's keep going, let's keep entertaining. And we are not often allowed to sit and reflect on how sad we are, how things are spinning out of control. And at the time, we were, every day, it seems like, you know, every hour almost, we were getting new news about someone else who had died. Members of our arts community, members of the Black community, the queer community, artists of all races and religions and sexualities, and people in general were just dying around us. Yeah. And I was sitting thinking, I don't want to keep creating in the midst of that. I want to stop and acknowledge that we're losing so many people right now, and we are under a stay in place order that is forever, right? We don't know when it's going to end. And even though there is always a semblance of hope, right? We never want to lose hope. It is a reality that we don't know when this is going to end, and we also don't know what it's going to look like when it restarts. There's no going back to what it was, really, in the true sense. And so it's okay for us to stop and grieve, and just for a minute, you know, just take a breath and say, where are we? Who are we? And acknowledge the loss we are experiencing. And now that we've been in this for several months, I am more at a place where, okay, I can start talking about the state of theater again. I can start talking about creation again. But I really wanted to honor the folks who were lost, and I wanted to honor what we were losing, especially as theater artists, or performers in general. One of my favorite kind of categorizations of the theater is from Bill English at SF Playhouse, mm-hmm. who called theater an empathy jam, where we exercise our muscles of compassion.
What? And that is so perfect, right?
No, right? And I love that. And I did with them several years ago, and I remember hearing that for the first time. Then it was like probably 5 years ago, and I was like, exactly. Mm-hmm. The theater has always been a place of healing, and it's been a place where we learn how to navigate different ideas, different asks, different wants, desires, needs, and we're all sitting in the same place together, and we're figuring it out together. Yep. It's the ultimate place of democracy, or at least it should be. And I think that one of the things that I long for, as we could think about how do we come back as theater artists, how do we come back as a community, is to really redefine theater as this, you know, neat, this spectacle, Latin entertainment purpose only form. Yeah. Although entertainment is important, right? And right. Spectacle is, I think, as well. Those are things that I think we should lose completely. But I think we do need to start thinking about how do we get back to what the theater was originally, right? Not just starting in the Greek theater, but starting all the way from indigenous tribes in Africa. And indigenous tribes in the Americas, when the act of performance, of storytelling, of dancing, of singing together was an acknowledgement of ancestors, of community, of healing, of agreement, of disagreement, mm-hmm. Figuring out conflict, fighting against conflict. It was a language of war, of peace, of joy, of love. And I think sometimes you forget where it was rooted in, what theater was rooted in. It was rooted in one person standing up and telling a story, mm-hmm. to his or her community. And that is a place that I think we can go back to, right? We can start saying, whoa, theater isn't about glamour, it's about the story. And people joining in together, listening to those stories. And I am, And so even though I grieve what we have lost, I also look forward to what we can build together, what we can create together. And I think we're at a place now where we can do that, right? And theater community was in that place in the 60s and 70s as well, when, you know, the famous Peter Brook was writing his empty, you know, the empty space, and really starting to think about what is theater and why do we do it, and is it important to us? And trying to ask and figuring it out why it's important to us. And I think that's an opportunity that we have, even through all the grief that we're experiencing right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And the place where theater started, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's always been about telling the story of the society around us and that surrounds us. And and honestly, like, this is probably the most cheesy reference ever. But I remember a time in my life where I resisted going into the theater. My wife drugged me to a show, a little musical called Wicked, right? Mm-hmm. And I was this, you know, anti-war activist, and I was into just like, it's got to be about this, you know, like it has to be. And then I go into Wicked, and then I you know, listen to the story, and it's like, okay, so they're taking away the animal's intelligence. They're mm-hmm. hiding things from them, you know. They're grouping them all together as one and calling them certain names. To me, that's kind of like there's a little bit of the 10 stages of genocide there going on in the midst of Wicked, this slick mega musical. And I was like, okay, I'm back on the train.
Absolutely,
you know,
absolutely. Absolutely. And also with Elphaba being this green witch of color, right? And like this activist who is a femme voice of color in this. And I know that that's could be controversial, but she is green, it's other. And how many times throughout history have the othered led revolutions?
Yes.
And been as bad and terrible, and they're evil, they don't want us to survive, when they're really speaking truth to power. And something that I tell my students all the time is that all art is political, mm-hmm. right? We can put little bows on it, right. And we can make it musical, and we can say, look how fun we had. But at the end of the day, it's all political. It's political based on like really understanding what the narrative is about. It's political in whose voice is being heard and whose voice is not being heard in the space. I think that we have hidden messages of revolution behind pretty bows and bells and whistles. Mm-hmm. And important, I think, sometimes, right? To like get the masses and show them some fancy flair. But that's where the dramaturgs come in, right? That's where the theater scholars come in and say, right. So Wicked. And you had a great time. Yeah. Now this is what it's really about. And now let's go like start a revolution. And I think that is what's so beautiful about the form of theater, is that we are able to package it however we want. Mm-hmm. Message of revolution, the message of being different and standing out from the crowd, and charging the Bastille, so to speak, is always there. Mm-hmm. Even in something as benign as Meet Me in St. Louis, right? It's always there. And we have to see it, we have to look at it and say, what are we saying? And how is culture being reflected here? And what culture isn't being reflected here? And how is that itself a form of political erasure, mm-hmm. or political growth, right? I think that is really important. But I hear you. I was in the same place of, of like, what is all this mess of, like, I'm sick of seeing all these dance numbers. Like, let's get to some revolutions. But as I studied the theater and as I started to study theory, I'm like, oh, right. We have to look deeper than that. Mm-hmm. And we have to the core of it. I love that. I love that. And also, something I'm thinking about as well, and I think that we can start doing more in the theater, is really thinking about our audience and how they're involved in the performative space. I think we have for too long placed a proscenium as God, right. of the theater. We too long said you're up there and I'm out here, and that's that distance, and we need to do that. One of the things that I'm so lucky to do is work in a black box all the time, and I'm able to really think about my audience as a part of the storytelling. Yeah. What are they doing? what is a part of, who are they? Why are they there? And they're not just passive onlookers. They're actively involved in the storytelling. And I think for theater to survive in this theater 3.0 or 5.0 or whatever version we're on, is for us to really start thinking about how does community fit into this? How do we really engage the audience, and not just the elite, but all bodies, voices in those places? How do we engage those? How do we bring them to the table? And how do we do work that's for them and about them? And one of the things that Broadway closing is gonna enable us to do is that we're not gonna be so beholden to just reproducing a tour of a Broadway show.
You do a lot of your work as a educator in the Black Box facility. You've been able to experiment with performance space and how that informs the form, if you will, of the show itself, right? And so and I think that's a huge what that does. I mean I can literally see the rippling of your students' brains happening in my mind, because they're having to entertain those options, whereas if you're in a facility where it's a classic proscenium, you're more kind of beholden, like you said, to more of a conservative form of theater. And then the audience involvement, you know, it really kind of will be more tailored towards what are you teaching them on the way in and what are you teaching them on the way out, kind of a thing. Absolutely. More of a lobby involvement, which can still work. And I've done stuff like that, you know, that OSF, Oregon Shakespeare, has done stuff to inform audiences on the way in, intermission, and on the way out. But man, performance spaces really do just completely transform a story. If you could, like, I don't know if you could think of on the top of your head of one example when you've altered a performance space, whether it's altering the audience or altering a set or props on stage, that really kind of heightened a moment in a piece that you've done.
One that comes to mind right away is last year, I believe. Years are weird right now. We did a production of Marisol at Country Council School, at this couple spa. And it's Marisol is a magical realism play by Jose Rivera. Mm-hmm. And it focuses around a young lady, Marisol, who is visited by an angel. And the angel tells her that that our God as we know him, or it, or they, or she, whatever form it
is. Yeah.
Realism world has gone senile, and through this being senile has caused the earth to start decaying in weird ways, and that she had to fight. It was now time to pick up the armor and fight. And so this is a political piece, and it was one that really talks about how do we act when power is not on our side. Like, what do we do when those in power abandon us? Or is it really speaking for us? And in that play, we were considering a lot of different ways of designing the show. But what we ended up doing is creating four quadrants of audience. Those four quadrants created the acting space into the form of a cross. And so we continually saw this idea of crucifixion and sacrifice and rebirth and this imagery of the cross that was not an actual cross hanging on a wall, but it was the floor because the audience was sitting in a cross shape. And that was the first act. And then the second act, we had every audience member leave the theater space. And we said, prepare for war, prepare for war. We had the crew come out. We said, prepare for war, prepare for war. We have war sounds going. But during that time when the audience was in the lobby, we completely changed the seating arrangement. And the seating arrangement exploded throughout the theater. So there was chair here, chair there, chairs against the wall, chairs beside each other. I don't know what just happened there. I got really close up. Yeah, and so they came into a world that had been flipped on its head, and their audience members were sitting in these 11 or 12 chairs that were throughout the space, They're intermixed with the audience, with the actors. And so they were really in it. Yeah. And all, again, the number 12 is this really important faith and theology. And so we were playing with number 12, with these 12 disciples, 12 knights. And the audience, so actors were literally on each, like in their faces. And there was asks of the audience, like, hold this gun, hold this thing. And one of the things, so the year before that, the summer before that, I was able to travel to London. I did a whole Europe tour, but I was in London and I went to the Bridge Theater, was formed by folks who were at the National Theater and moved to create their own work. And I saw a production of Julius Caesar there. Wow. And I was able to be on the ground floor where we were all groundless and we were standing on the floor with them. And we were in the war. Like when the war, there was debris falling on us when they had to move us. I was like, move out the way. And I was like, wow. And I remember when the show ended, I was standing there with my friend and I was like, I can't breathe. It just took my breath away. And I wanted to replicate that somehow in our space. And we were able to. The audience was blown away by the fact they were in it. And they had nowhere to hide. And they were all looking at each other and seeing each other and reacting to each other. And there was no hiding place. There was no dark audience. You were in stage light. You were seen. You were asked to act. And then the question was, okay, why didn't you act, right? You have the space to act, you have the space to intervene. Why didn't you? And that's not to place blame or to say you should do more better, but it was really just to say, let's think about all of the times mm-hmm. that we have seen in which we could have acted.
Yep.
And we didn't. And let's analyze that for ourselves. And let's think about, can we do better? What are we afraid of? Is our personal safety more important than community and collective safety? And especially right now during a pandemic, that question of is our personal safety, more important, our personal comfort more important than the collective is coming out in full force.
Absolutely.
I mean, free news cycle, it's like that debate of personal liberty and personal comfort versus collective community safety. And that moment in that play was representative of that as well.
Absolutely. God, it's almost prophetic when you describe it as kind of like a social experiment that you guys did. And, you probably didn't even need to gather data because the data was in the minds of the actors and their observation and how they could probably report all of that back to the directors and how you described it with the moving of the audience, it's kind of like an order versus chaos, and where do you fall, and what are you going to do within each role? Are you going to sacrifice yourself to be an orderly person, or are you going to, in the midst of chaos, actually step up and be a mover and a shaker? I mean, man, those are just absolute human at the core of who we are questions that you guys were asking of that audience. And I only wish that I could be a part of it because I'm like excited about it, but I'm like, oh, it's over. So I can't see it.
Right. What was also beautiful at that moment too, is that these were students, right? These were ninth graders, 10th graders, 11th graders, 12th graders, 14-year-olds, right? And they're asking these big questions. Some of them as young as 13, asking these big questions. And, of course we had some parents who were like, oh, this is a lot, right? And I'm like, when do we teach them? Mm-hmm. If not in educational settings, when, right? When do they learn? And sometimes by the time they're in college or out of college, it's too late.
Be at least a little bit of a wire that carries that electrical current to turn that light bulb on. And some of the questions that you're asking to them, and then the questions they're asking, it just sounds like the ripple effect from your theater program with Melissa, as you said, is just going to it's going to ripple outward towards professional theater for years to come. And I'm so looking forward to hearing of all the great things that your students are going to do.
Me too. I'm so excited. You know, I currently don't have any children of my own, and I may not have them ever. I'm a queer Black person in America, so who knows if I will have children of my own. But these are, like, I think of them as my kids. They are my legacy. They are a history that I leave behind. And I'm from Louisiana, and so much of our cultural to Louisiana, it's all about ancestry and heritage and what stories are behind. And I get to see them go out into the world and create new stories and be those game changers. And that's how we do it, right? Even during this horrible pandemic online classes where I'm like, oh God, okay, here we go. Let's try it again. I still get so much joy from them and seeing how they're so resilient, what they're coming up with. They're coming up with some really cool stuff. If they can do that right now with all the hardships, mm-hmm. what can they do to have access? I'm just so thrilled. I'm so thrilled.
Absolutely. And the, the opportunities are still there. They're just a little different, you know, at this point. And I feel like the students, from my perspective as well, are really doing the best that I could expect them to do, given the current situation. So I'm like, let's try to build on this and let's try to create some momentum going in the new year. When we do get back in person, whenever that might be, we're going to have some stories to tell of how the roads that we all traveled during this time period. That's one of the things that I feel like will come of this in terms of theater art, is that we are tasked to tell this story for generations now. Mm. You know, like, this isn't just about the virus. The virus is exposing all these different issues that are within our communities, both local and global. Is that something that you've thought about, and what specific issues do you feel like have been kind of unlocked in everyone's faces now?
Wow. Just, accessibility for multiple voices has been unlocked, right? And I mean, seeing that on the news that Black communities and Latinx communities are in so much trouble with this virus, right? They have the highest death rates in the community, and also the Native Indigenous communities are having high death rates and not getting support they need. It's showing we already knew, right? That the healthcare system here is not designed for people who are of color, really. It's also not designed for people who are poor. And we're seeing that unlocked every day, that, you know, folks who didn't have insurance die of COVID. Folks who are of color are dying of COVID. I mean, and many folks are dying of, you know, we have many people are dying and getting sick, and I don't want to erase any lives lost. Sure. But when we look at the data, we're seeing so much of what we have been seeing already in regards to how the healthcare system treats marginalized communities. That's being blown up. And something else that I see often too is this idea of product over people, right? This rush to get back to making money, this rush to get back to an economy that is profitable, this rush to put people back in work in dangerous situations just so they can make a product that they can't even afford to buy. It's being right now. And as someone who, I mean, I believe that we should be able to have upward mobility, and I believe that we should be able to make money and to be successful in some ways. But whatever that means, success means in a kind of capitalist system. But I also know that if you're not taking care of people's basic needs to begin with, then you're not going to have a profitable democracy in general, right? You're going to have this horrible wealth controlling all of our decisions, all the what's happening in healthcare, in workforce, and work, you know, in the workforce, and I really and also how and state violence against people of color is simply increasing, right? You see, there is a higher rate of folks who of color being cited or arrested for breaking stay-in-place orders. And it's like, well, look at Dolores Park, and then I look at the Bayview, and I'm thinking, there's some inequity there. But we already knew that, right? But I think that this is heightening it, because we're all looking at it. We have nothing else to do, right? We are all home, so all we can look at is see the amount of inequity that is coming over and over and over and over again to these marginalized communities. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the you know, the House of Representatives are really trying to navigate that world and rely and like and take, you know, and like, this is not good. let's create stimulus plans and let's figure it out. And I think other folks are doing less, right? And I, you know, I won't say any names, but other folks are doing less. And so I think it is important for us to reevaluate what is happening in our healthcare systems, what is happening in our welfare systems, what is happening within our workforces, and whose voice should really be in charge there. When you have people like Elon Musk threatening to leave California if you don't open up these shops, it's like, come on, let's talk about collective healing first before we start talking about capital gain.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head with the capitalist commentary. It really does seem like it's brought to the forefront of the conversation, and it's a shame that there isn't a anti-capitalist in the national spotlight right now, because this person was urged to step aside in the presidential race. It would be nice to hear this evaluation on a larger level, as opposed to, you know, simple you know, conversations or even you know, tweets or whatever that can go out. The focus right now, a lot of the media play has been on reopening. When are we going to reopen? Yeah. Elon Musk, everybody knows who he is and what he says for a reason, because his views are promoted. And it's a shame that people had to feel the blunt smack of capitalism in their face to actually know that it's a bad thing for a collective society that depends upon commerce and trade and labor, and not just, you know, making our, you know, our one moment shine and make a ton of money off of it. This is and always will be a labor driven nation, until, of course, we're all not here anymore, which of course they're working on at the very moment, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. We have to take care of folks who are working. We have to take care of the laborer, the proletariat, whatever language you want to use. Exactly. You have to take care of them. And because we cannot do anything without them. And I think also within the arts community, it's really clear, like our healthcare system I'm a part of Actors Equity, and our union is really having to face some of its problems when it comes to how we take care of our people. Yeah. And the Actors Union is, you know, thinking about union wages and healthcare and the state of backstages in professional theaters and how they're often not really deep cleaned. Like there's a lot of things that we have to face here. work conditions have not been great for artists either. And I think that, you know, earlier this year, right, when AB5 was the biggest thing on our mind, right. which so seems so far away now, but it's like, yes, I know AB5 was difficult and it was hard on our many of our smaller companies. But at the end of the day, companies that were, you know, in existence for 15, 20, 30, 45 years should have already been trying to find pathways of paying their actors equitably. And yet, because it's a product centric form now, the artists who are doing that work, the worker, is being put to the side. And I think that in the art, we have a reckoning.
You had also mentioned about people of color and Latinx communities. Me being a mixed breed kind of a person, my dad's Puerto Rican and my mom is white, so I'm kind of like, you know, I have my own thing going on in terms of who I'm trying to be and identify as in this world. But fully identifying as a Latinx person, it's really the virus is completely exposing the inequities of the healthcare system, the political system, and the system of labor in terms of who is lacking healthcare and who is dying on the front lines of this virus. And it's people of Latinx and African American communities. And at this point, I honestly feel as a, I kind of look at myself as a burrowed activist. Like I did marches, I did protests, I did all that. And then all of a sudden I got married and then I had a kid and then, and then I started my profession. And then now I'm working from my perspective to try to inform the next generation. But I feel as if this is as close as we've been to a catalyzing moment in activism as we've been in my lifetime. What do you feel about that in terms of where we're at now and how far we can actually be pushed till people are just out in the streets?
Yeah. So I same, I've done my share of marching. I've had, you know, guns in my face from the state. You know, I've done all of that, and I will continue to do it if need be, and as occasion arise. I think there's a place for all types of activism right now. Right. So I don't think everyone should be in the street. I think doing the work that you're doing and doing the writing work and also uplifting those communities is equally important, because the folks who are potentially more able-bodied or have that gung-ho energy still can then go out and do that work for us as well. I do believe that this is a catalyzing moment, because we see what happens when we sit in being okay with the status quo. Right, we see who we get in leadership. We see that we're now in a global pandemic. We see, and not only that we're in a global pandemic, but we are utterly unprepared for it. Because it's not the fact that we're in a pandemic itself, but we are utterly unprepared for it. Yeah. And that's something that we should be shaking our finger at and rising up against. And also with the availability of resources now, folks can really see what's going on and have the time to sit with it and say, wow, I hate this. How do I fix it? We really do need to turn on the pressure. Oftentimes we talk about the civil rights movement as these peaceful movements, right? And the queer rights movement as peaceful movements. And yes, there were moments of peace. But these are, we're gonna sit here and be peaceful and not make any change. No, there are radical moments of peace. Mm-hmm. There were for the first time that we are here and we're not moving. Mm-hmm. You can't.
Yep.
That's radical, right? And but also there was intentional moments of violence. Mm-hmm. Right now, we need to create art that also demands us to do better, and we have to uplift voices that are demanding us to do better. We're not doing great right now, mm-hmm. and you know, even myself, I can get bogged down in the day-to-day of, well, I'm working and I'm tired and whatever. But at the end of the day, lives are at stake. People are dying. And people are dying at the hand of poor management, racism, homophobia, transphobia, sexism. And it is a problem. And we need to step back and say, what can I individually do every day to help fix it? Yeah.
And you teach a class on isms. So you just nailed a few right there too. If I could add to it also, because those are all absolutes, like those are absolute isms that require immediate attention if our society is going to resume democracy at any point. Also ageism you're seeing a lot right now, right?
With absolutely
who I can't believe how many conservative people I've heard on news talk about how many older individuals they're okay with dying right now,
right?
And that's a problem when when the propaganda model that they're putting out there through the media, people in charge are putting out there through the media, is being accepted, when a group of people, which we've obviously seen this before with other groups of people, but now on literally explaining away a whole generation of people dying is it's new to even me. And I've been around since the Reagan years. I was a kid back then and I heard it all, but now I really have, you know?
Right, absolutely. And I remember when we were first, when the first phase of, you know, stay home a little bit, we were not completely settling in place, but first hearing that it is impacting elderly you know, our elders in a higher rate, folks were like, oh, cool, not me. And not just conservatives, right? It was my liberal friends who were like, great, cool, we can keep partying. And it's, why are we so fast to throw away the those lives and the folks who are our elders who have created pathways for us to do what we are able to do now? They're definitely, you know, in my hometown, many of our elders that I grew up with that were leaders in our community have passed away, and I am from this virus, and those people were like instrumental in my mother's life, in my grandmother's life, in my grandfather's life, in my life, and what I do, right? Even if our views did not always align, they are instrumental in teaching me how to stand up for justice, right? How to stand up. And there's no, we cannot erase and say, oh, well, elderly, well, they've lived their lives. Like, who, what? You know, even like people like Terrence McNally, right? Who was a great writer for the stage, and someone who was a queer leader, you know, as well. Is his life worth our resistance to be collective in our safety practices? No, right? Like it is, and I think that, but unfortunately, capitalism has always, you know, individualism first. And America in general has unfortunately had a lot of individualist policies. And so we're having to reshift our thinking and reshape our minds because we cannot survive with that anymore.
It seems like the virus and the response to it is a perfect opportunity for people in power to start chipping away at institutions that work towards certain ends. I don't know. I mean, that's just a thought I'm kind of putting out there, but what do you think that we're going to have to, what is worth fighting for in terms of the art of theater and performance?
Yeah. So I really do consider theater a healing place. I think it's a place where we can explore each other's humanity, and we can say, look, we're all here. We all have differences, and yet we're all collectively here together. And I think what we have to fight for is a way to keep that collective energy going. how do we, because right, because I think about myself in this, in set stay in place quarantine right now. Mm-hmm. And what I miss the most is walking down a hallway at school and like seeing one of my colleagues in the arts department and us just like ripping on the state of the art, right? Us finding moments of frustration and disagreement and healing together. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's worth fighting for. I'm not really interested in fighting for the spectacle right now. Right? We'll get the spectacle again. We'll get, you know, right. values again. I don't care about that right now. Right. I care about simple stories told by simple human beings with, in front of, with, for and with the folks in the audience. And whether that's 10 people, 20 people, outside, in a bar, on a street corner, you know, I don't care. I think it is important for us right now to find ways to collectively heal. One of the things after my one of my best friends passed away 2.5 years ago at this point, and right after their death, we were all so stunned and shocked. It was all so sudden, and I said to myself, we need to come together. We need to have people at our house. Like, we need a moment of collective healing, because it is that, right? I do not believe that, I think therapy is important. And I think our current system of how we, you know, work with psychologists and psychiatrists to a therapist to help heal us is important. But that's only one way, right? It's usually just you and a therapist. And that is one way, but throughout history, and I mean, I go back to Africa, I go back to the Americas, I go back to indigenous cultures. It's collective healing, right? Cultures in which stood in circles and they sang together while you experienced your pain. Watching documentaries and watching past cultures of weeping together at the loss of a loved one. And you don't even have to know that person, right? But you're just there and you're in collective solidarity. And that is a form of theater as well. That's a form of performative as well. And I think that is what's so important, that we are once again given a space that we can collectively heal and figure it out together. And the healing can be through laughter, through crying, through breathing together, through saying ashe at the end of the show. Whatever that may be, that's what I'm fighting for. I'm fighting for that moment again, to collectively heal together.
I could not have asked anyone to explain it any better than that, AJ. Man, thank you. Yeah. Your words are literally healing me at this moment, and giving me ideas on how we could all collectively grieve in our theater department upon return, when we do finally see each other and rejoice. Thank you for informing me on that and educating me as you have now every single time we've spoken.
I'm just thankful for the conversation. It's been great. I love talking about art, and I do less of that because I'm stuck here. But any moment to talk to an adult about art, I'm happy for. So I'm so thankful for you for having me.
Well, thank you. You're the first theater person I thought of to talk to for this podcast. And so I can't wait to get it out there for everybody, my students, your students, everybody to hear.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for tuning in to episode 3 of Artivism Now. I'm your host, Kyle Roman, signing off. Thank you to AJ Mitchell for being our guest today. And thank you to all the artists out there doing their thing in their communities. We're looking for more artists to profile. So if you can, get in contact with us on Instagram at artivism_now or on Twitter at artivismnow. You can also follow me personally at The Right Life, LYFE, on Instagram. I'd love to hear from you. And as usual, let that art flow. Let it mean something.
and goodbye.